This is the Amp Hour Podcast, released April 14th, 2019. Episode 438, an interview with Bart Drink. Welcome to the Amp Hour. I'm Chris Gamble of Contextual Electronics.
And I'm Bart Dring with BuildLog.net.
Hey, Bart. How you doing?
I'm doing great.
This is our, the fifth ever in-person recording. But this is the new rig setup, and so I appreciate you being
okay,
here.
Okay. Well, it's my first.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. People probably know you from your robots, right?
Yeah. Mostly CNC and motion control, things like that.
I know you because we share a locker at MHub.
We do. I have one-fifth of the locker.
That's right, right, right. And so what are the things that you're building here?
Well, I try and build anything that has to do with motion control and CNC. Mm-hmm. And lately I've been working at a small scale to try and just learn a lot of things without spending a lot of money. And that's sort of what I've been doing lately.
Yeah, yeah. It feels like a lot of ESPs and then like plug-in boards, but also they're low cost enough that they seem really accessible.
Yeah, that's the goal, and so I've been doing the ESP32 thing as part of that because it's a really tiny little chip, it's cheap, and the Wi-Fi and Bluetooth make it so that you don't have to lug around a laptop, too.
Yeah, that's great, that's great. Yeah, we'll definitely get back to that stuff, too. You do a lot of motion control stuff. Like, how did you get into that? Why motion control in the first place?
Well, it started as kind of a hobby. I was working at a company and just doing some things on my own free time and stumbled across a pile of stepper motors and started looking around.
The junk bin problem, yeah.
The junk bin, yeah. And knew that, they rotated. That's about all I knew.
Okay,
and accurately. So started searching around to see what people were doing with them. And at that time, which was about 15, 16 years ago, quite a while ago, noticed a lot of people were doing CNC, and so I built my first CNC, and that's how I got started in it and kind of got hooked on it.
What was your history prior to the pile of stepper motors?
Okay. Well, going way back to my first job, I worked at Williams Electronics designing pinball machines.
Oh, man. I just saw a thing about competitive pinball here in Chicago, too. There was an article that was like, if you ever want your palms to sweat while watching someone do pinball, it's like, okay, but still, like it's a thing here, right?
It is. Chicago was kind of the headquarters of pinball back in the day, and so I got this job at the entry level and was doing all sorts of things. But quickly, just because I was so young and eager, worked my way up to being able to design anything they were doing. And they had done some video games. Pinball was kind of dying, and then video games were coming along, and they did games like Defender and Joust and Robotron. I don't know if you've heard of those.
Well, I've read Ready Player One 4 times, so yeah, I've definitely heard of at least Joust.
Yeah. But then Pac-Man came along and was really just killing everyone else in the industry, so they decided to make a go at it again with pinball machines and tried to put a little more life into them than they had where they'd left off, and
so like electrifying the playing field more, that kind of thing of like,
yeah, and sort of making it more three-dimensional. Now if you look at a pinball machine, it's almost like three levels with wire racks and stuff like that, and we were the first people to do that. And we did games like Space Shuttle and a couple other games which were the first, and I was right in there working with all that stuff, working with guys like Python Angelo and Steve Kordak, and these are famous names.
Yeah, you say I don't know any of these names, but I'm sure the people that are pinball, like I know Jeff Kaiser's a big pinball, the Mighty Young, big pinball guy. I'm sure he's listening like, what?
Yeah. So it was fun. I really didn't know what I was doing. You know, these were just other workers there.
Yeah.
It was fun. I mean, back then companies were so kind of stale and stodgy, but this was more like a startup kind of environment where people like stayed all night and you know, slept on the floor and,
the cultural thing, huh?
Yeah, and I was really attracted to that. That's so cool. That was a lot of fun, but after about 3 years I kind of got the itch that like, am I really an engineer where I'm, you know, making pinball machines, and decided to look around and got another job In hindsight, it was a really stupid way to think about it because, you know, sure, I was having a great time and I was doing some good mm-hmm. stuff, and the people that stayed there did some really amazing stuff. Mm-hmm. But it was just an itch I needed to scratch and get out of there.
I think that's the thing, though, like the that quote unquote real engineer thing, like that. I've asked that of myself in the past, too. It's like, am I doing everything that I, you know, that I have this ideal of what an engineer is out there? And it's like, at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter if you're enjoying what you're building new things. But
right.
But I think that that's a common thing.
Yeah, and I was worried, you know, how it would look on a resume. You know, oh, I did the pop-up clown and the all these funny things. And
tell me about a time that you designed a pop-up clown, Bart.
But now in interviews and things like that, you know, when I talk to other engineers, they get all excited about the pinball stuff. So yeah, it probably was wrong about that
just,
as well.
I just always think about, like, the current draw on the solenoids and everything. Like, it's just, like, serious.
Oh yeah. It dims all the lights and mm-hmm. you know, it's pretty pretty crazy. I'd love to get back into designing some of that stuff, but it's crazy expensive. Mm-hmm. A solenoid for a flipper can cost $100, you know.
Seriously. Oh wow.
And you know, you got a, you know, maybe two dozen of them mm-hmm. when you have all the kickers and all that. Yeah, so it's pretty unapproachable as a hobby.
Yeah. Yeah, I know Romain is someone who worked on like an open pinball. He actually came to a thing here in town and he was doing a it's like an open pinball playing format. And it was like lower cost, but it was like the electronics were lower cost. It feels like the components you're saying, it's just a lot of copper, a lot of metal, just heavy duty stuff and low volume now too, right?
Yeah, and there's a lot of wear too. So, you know, the pinball you know, is striking things with mm-hmm. a lot of force, and the solenoids are cracking into hard end stops mm-hmm. and stuff mm-hmm. and things just fall apart mm-hmm. if you don't design them well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what'd you do after that then?
Then I worked at a company that did high-power transmitters, microwave transmitters for satellite communication and deep space networks, and completely different.
Let's talk about pinball again. Come on, no, that's super cool.
Yeah, it was interesting, and worked my way up, and probably worked there for over 20 years.
Wow!
And was the mechanical engineering manager mm-hmm. for most of the time, mm-hmm.
And that probably has like a lot of impact on, like, because microwave is so like shape dependent. You always got those crazy ass antennas and doing weird things. It's probably, it's not just designing a box, I'm guessing.
Yeah, it's not just designing a box. We were working with klystrons and traveling wave tubes.
Oh, wow.
We were really high power, you know, multi-kilowatt. And so, there's a lot to do with high voltage mm-hmm. And high power dissipations. Mm-hmm. And then the RF has to be transmitted through waveguide mm-hmm. because it's just, it'll smoke a piece of coax. And so you have like waveguide switches and all sorts of things that are really exotic.
Yeah, what do those look like?
Well, waveguide is like a rectangular cross-section tube that is like proportional to the wavelength. Mm-hmm. So it's like this rectangle that's going from the transmitter all the way to the antenna.
So like a like almost an extruded piece of copper or something like that?
Yeah, okay. Exactly. So when you go, let's say you want to switch it for like a redundant system. So if one transmitter goes down, you can bring the other one up. It's done mechanically. It's like this rotating piece of a 90-degree angle of this rectangular waveguide.
Oh, that's super cool.
Yeah. And some of it, like the lower frequencies, like the 2 gigahertz stuff can be 3 inches by 6 inches.
Holy crap.
And then like the high stuff, like 50 gigahertz might be, you know, that same in millimeters, three mm-hmm. millimeters yeah, by six sure, millimeters. Sure, yeah. So it's pretty interesting. But the high voltage was always a big challenge because mm-hmm. You're basically doing a switching power supply that has like 220 in and 10 kilovolts out.
Oh, lost a lot of good men out there.
Yeah, we didn't lose anyone.
That's good.
But doing printed circuit boards that are floating at 10,000 volts is pretty interesting. A lot of challenges. Yeah. You know, you talk about creepage and clearance and stuff like that. This is, you know, measured in inches.
Yeah, right.
And everything's potted. But then you've got all this heat, you know, maybe a kilowatt of heat sometimes that you got to get out of this potting area.
Wow. Did you do like heat guides too then? Or how did you get it out of the potting?
There were some ceramics that were relatively conductive, like alumina and beryllium oxide mm-hmm. and other exotic ceramics. And they can conduct heat and not the voltage. Mm. So we would do it that way. But then sometimes you just need to get a really large heat sink. So we would use heat pipes to spread it to farther points and things like that. And just a ton of air.
Yeah, right.
And so multi-horsepower.
When you first said satellite, I thought you meant it was going up in the satellite. I'm guessing
this is all terrestrial stuff. Okay. So if you've ever seen the trucks, with, news trucks with the big antennas on the back,
oh, yeah.
We made a lot of stuff that went in there.
Okay.
And so we did mundane stuff like, you know, the feed for the Home Shopping Network. Not very exciting, but...
Hey, I bet there was money in it, though.
These, you know, a little box the size of audio amplifier would sell for $50,000. There was money in it. But then we did deep space networks for, deep space probes, things like that.
Like selling to the deep space network, like the three antennas?
Yes, exactly.
Oh,
yeah.
I've seen one.
Yeah.
I've been to one. Yeah.
Canberra, right?
Yeah, that's right. That place had
it's like
some
a football
gear.
Field that they can steer.
Exactly. Did you get to go out there?
No, I've seen the one in Pasadena, though.
Okay, yeah.
And I think there's one in Spain. Is that where the other one is?
I think so, yeah.
Okay.
I didn't know that there's one in Pasadena. I thought it was somewhere else.
There is one. I don't know if it's part of the triad.
I thought the third one was somewhere else, but maybe I'm wrong.
Okay.
But yeah, I'm sure JPL's got
yeah.
a bunch of gear.
I think so.
Yeah.
That was cool. And then we also did a lot of military communication stuff.
Sure.
Right after 9/11, all those wars out in the desert, they had a lot of bandwidth requirements because suddenly, they were in the middle of nowhere and they were having
video feeds. They want internet.
They want internet. Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
And they use X-band and they were using up the satellite capabilities. So they started leasing commercial satellites and that meant they had to have a whole new set of equipment. So that was... a big market for us. And that was interesting because the ambient temperature we had to operate in was 60 C.
Oh, my God.
That's about it's 140 like, F, I think.
Yeah, right. Because you got it's 110 degrees outside, 100 or whatever it is.
Oh, but 30, it's more than that,
30
yeah.
C outside, but yeah. And then you got
a blazing sun.
Yep, and, and you're inside a case then. And
yeah.
Oh, my God.
So that was a big challenge.
Is that like changing to like silicon carbide and like really exotic materials or what had to change?
Yeah, the materials you can work with are somewhat limited. You know, you get what you can.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just increasing the cooling capabilities and, increasing the airflow and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's crazy.
And a lot of it was outdoor rated, so it was like on the back of a Humvee.
Yeah, right.
That was kind of crazy, too, because like those television news gathering trucks, you know, as soon as there's a hurricane, they want to go down there and film it.
Yeah,
so you
right.
have to be able to have your outdoor equipment just sitting out, on the back of an antenna in hurricane conditions.
So what are some things that you could teach our listening audience about designing for hurricane and or desert conditions?
Yeah, I don't know.
Start with $50,000.
Yeah.
Or more.
Yeah, well, the thing is the military specs are all published, and you can get those. And they're really a good place to start with, like for exotic environments. You know, let's say, you know, how much rain do I really need to deal with? And you can just look that up and find it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, it'll tell you that maybe 90% of the activities are covered by, like, 4 inches an hour and 50-mile-an-hour wind. You can start with that. And then they have tests to find for you and labs that are already set up to do it.
That's
so,
great.
Just design, test, iterate.
Mm-hmm. Pay money. It's right. Yeah.
Yeah, lots of big, thick gaskets.
Yeah, that's...
You know, you want something that's compliant, you know, that kind of bends and moves with the weather.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. So then how did that... Was that where you found all the steppers? Or was
I think I stumbled across the stepper motors there.
Okay.
And started playing with them and did the CNC machines.
Mm. And so, like, when you say CNC machines, can you define CNC machine?
It's basically, computer-controlled motion.
Mm-hmm.
So anytime you're doing precise motion in multi-axis, that's what I consider CNC, coordinated motion.
Yeah.
You know, so you got to go from X1, Y2 to X5, Y5, and, you know, within a perfectly straight line under really tight control.
Yeah.
So it's broad, you know, 3D printers, a CNC machine.
Milling, right? We're both at MHUB right now.
Stuff.
We're there may be a milling machine that kicks on at some point, and we will definitely hear it if that is the case, because they're also they're loud. And so John Saunders has also been on the show before, so I'll call that out too. So he's at NYC CNC, same kind of things, I guess. That as he's using it instead of building it, I'm guessing.
Right.
He's doing the machining piece.
Yeah. So it, like plasma cutters, you know, even pen plotters, 3D printers.
Yeah.
Milling machines.
Routers. But actually, yeah, I guess Nadia Peake's been on the show as well, and she was doing the flexible. Did you see her stuff ever, where she makes one axis either rotational or linear, and then she kind of glues them together in different manners and makes different tools?
Yeah, I've seen some of her stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, there's another whole thing of robotics, which, you know, is very, very similar, and you use a lot of the same equipment, but it might be a little different. You know, you're trying to get to a target, but you might not really care. You know, as long as it stays within an envelope, that it gets there. So you could use vision, you know, to close the loop. Mm-hmm. But with CNC, you really have to precisely control every little aspect of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, okay, so that's probably good for talking about where we kind of are in the stack too, because it seems like, so like thinking about like a John Saunders, John is basically programming either in G code or some higher level like CAM or CAM, right? The tool path, which generates G codes. Or then even above that would be like 3D CAD. But now you're talking about even getting down below to like steps and sending steps to individual steppers.
Yeah, right? In the beginning, I was just using programs. There's like Mach 3 and Linux CNC, which were basically using the parallel port of a PC.
Mm-hmm. Until you couldn't find computers that had parallel ports anymore.
Right. Yeah, but back then they were everywhere.
Yeah,
I was using like 486s and... You know, they were pretty tightly coupled with that parallel port. And I think when they started abstracting a lot of stuff, that's when they lost that tight coupling and parallel ports. You know, you could get a USB parallel port, but it really wasn't the same old parallel port.
Yeah. I had one for my old CNC machine, and that was the thing that crashed every time. Like, if it was going to crash, it was going to crash at the USB to parallel
converter. Yeah, they really weren't, you know, as deterministic as the old like hardwired parallel port, because I think, you know, you send it to USB and USB is like, yeah, okay, when I'll get there.
Yeah.
So that's what we were using for that. And then I got into doing instructables things. I can't remember how I got started with that. But I did a series of instructables, and I think I was making some toys for the kids and stuff like that. Then one of them, I can't remember what the topic was, but I made a human-powered Segway. Okay. So basically a unicycle that looks like a Segway. It was kind
of like a lean forward, it goes forward kind of thing, or what?
No, it was completely human-powered. There wasn't a piece of electronics on it.
Okay.
And it was kind of a joke more than anything else, but it was getting all these votes as like to win this contest, which was Epilogue laser.
Oh, okay.
And I'm like, Epilogue laser, that sounds great. Yeah. You know, I'd love one of those.
Yeah.
And so I was getting all my friends to vote for this thing. Mm-hmm. And then I looked, as I was getting closer to the end, I started looking up, you know, the cost of one of these lasers. And they were like $18,000 to $20,000.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, holy crap, you know, I could have like a tax bill that would exceed what I even consider the value of this machine. Like if I went bought one at the store.
Or you just bought parts even, right?
Yeah, I like if I could go to the store and buy one, I'd probably pay $2,000 for it back then.
Sure.
And then here, you know, this is an $18,000 thing.
Yeah.
So I started thinking, well, maybe I can make my own.
Yeah.
And
did you win though? I mean,
I didn't win.
Ah.
I didn't deserve.
It's better
to
if
win.
You win and then you're like, I don't want it. I don't want the tax bill.
It was awesome though. But that like. Got me started doing a laser cutter.
Okay.
And I started that website, buildlog.net, and sort of like buildlog was I was going to log the whole process and stuff like that. And it was really the first comprehensive open source laser.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of what I got initially known for.
Mm-hmm.
It was called the 2.x laser. And so then I started selling kits for those and probably sold about 400 kits, laser kits.
Wow.
So a lot of people got them, and it was a pretty vibrant project.
So people kind of throwing in some help and feeding
back. Yeah, and that was – I really kind of got hooked on that, you know, like creating a community around something.
Yeah.
And, you know, you only have so much time. Mm-hmm. You know, people have all these great suggestions. You're like, yeah, okay, I'll put it on the, you know,
the someday list,
the roadmap.
Yeah.
And, but then, you know, someone else on the forum would be like, hey, you know, I had a few minutes, I gave it a try, and it really worked kind of cool. I tweaked it like this, and, you know, let's incorporate that into the thing. Mm-hmm. So I did, that was actually the second laser. That was the 2.x. The first one was clunky and made out of like a plywood frame. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to really simplify it. And the last thing I needed to simplify and lower the cost was the linear bearings. And we were using aluminum extrusions with glued on V-rails.
Okay. Could you explain what those things are?
Well, it was like a rectangular cross section, 20 by 40 millimeter, you know, T-slot extrusion. Mm-hmm. And then it did these metal Vs that you would glue on. And then, you know, the inverse shape of a wheel, a notched wheel, would roll on it. Mm-hmm.
So maybe like what's a good, is there a good product that people could think of that might use these kind of things?
Maker Slide. That's where I'm going.
All right.
So, what I thought was, well, maybe I can get an extrusion with the thing built in. It's only plastic wheels running on an aluminum extrusion. Mm-hmm. It can be all aluminum. So I did a Kickstarter for Maker Slide. And this was back in the early days. This is probably like 9 years ago.
Mm-hmm. So early days of Kickstarter, you said.
Early days of Kickstarter, before there was ever $1 million Kickstarter or anything like that. And I was asking for about $5,000 or $6,000. Got about, I can't remember, maybe 25,000, and worked out great. And made
which back then was not what people were saying either, because it was like a lot of people were starting Kickstarter without much knowledge of what they were doing.
Yeah, and I was one of them, and I learned a lot.
Sure, but you also had manufacturing experience. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like that's the I think the big difference.
Right, and one of the things that I learned is if you have a Kickstarter and you're looking for some money, plan for getting more money than you asked for, because you're basically saying, I'm going to work my butt off for these people that give me the money I need, and then I'll have this tool, this extrusion tool that I, you know, wanted. But then, you know, well, if you get more money than the extrusion tool, what are you going to do with it? You're basically working your ass off 4x more than you expected.
Right, right.
And so, you know, you... that's something to plan for. Plan for too much success. You know, you might have thought of this as a product launching another product. And so that was a bit of work, getting all that stuff out.
So what did you have to do to actually get Maker Slide out? So like basically you were then sourcing, you basically approached extrusion houses or something like that. And what does Maker Slide look like then too?
Maker Slide looks like, and I'm sure you'll put a link to the Kickstarter. It looks like a rectangular extrusion with two of the adjacent corners having little points on them.
Okay.
And those points are what the wheels roll on. It's a little like half triangle, well, no, triangles, like half diamonds. And the wheels roll on those. And it's since been extended. It was one of the first linear extrusions out there, but now there's like open builds and stuff like that, and they've got a lot of different ways of doing it. They actually did the negative of what I did. They made the Vs go into the extrusion, whereas I had them projecting out, and there's a lot of merit to that because the Vs that I have are very prone to damage, whereas they have them protected in a pocket. But now there's a lot of extrusions out there. And the interesting thing about the Kickstarter, it was re-kickstarted and Indiegogo, because it was open source, about five times around the world.
Really?
So I don't know if that's ever happened before, but there was Australia, the UK, all sorts of things where these different Kickstarters and Indiegogos.
So they basically took your files and they're like, I'm going to just do another run of this kind of
thing. Exactly. Oh, yeah. And now you can buy it natively in probably 8 to 10 tools around the world where you can buy it.
Wow, that's great. So it's kind of like a viral idea, but kind of actually replicated and manufactured different
Times. Yeah, a true open source idea.
You let it go into the wild and it's made its way into things.
And what was happening was I was still working 40 hours a week. But I would basically come home and I had these lasers, which I really enjoyed filling the orders for. But now I had Maker Slide. And so I would buy it So I would I got a company in Michigan to make the tool, and they make it, and I think you have to do about 1,000 pounds minimum.
It's a weird, like, that sounds very arbitrary, but it makes sense probably from a material and cost perspective.
Yeah, there's a lot of waste because they have to push it through the tool and tune it and things like that, and they use these giant billets of aluminum, and it's a really cool process.
Oh, yeah.
It looks like a locomotive with, you know, it's so hot you can't even approach this machine.
Yeah.
And
I always think of, like, Play-Doh, but, like, hot molten metal Play-Doh.
Yeah, but it really never, like, looks liquid. It is kind of like Play-Doh. Uh-huh. It you can see a little discoloration. I mean, aluminum doesn't get red when it gets hot.
Sure, yeah.
And so you really don't notice anything other than you just kind of see it sliding out, and it goes along these long tables, really long, like 300 meters long.
Whoa, really?
Yeah.
Wow. And like a whole factory almost then.
A whole factory, yeah, a long factory.
Wow. How do they cut it up later? Like, what do they
do? They cut it up later. Uh-huh. But what when they first push it out, there's like a wiggly end bit, you know, and then it goes out, and then as it's going down this table, it gets some slight distortions on it, and then they want to stretch it to get it straight again. And then they cut it, and where they cut it, you know, they kind of bend it a little. So there's a little waste at either end, but that stretching process gets it really straight. Mm. And then they have this table that kind of pushes it off to the side, and another piece comes out, and then they cut it. And they'll cut it to any length you want,
right.
But they charge for cutting.
Sure.
And,
but like, what is the, so that first piece after they stretch, like, how long is that? Is that like 100 meters long still?
Yeah, they don't really stretch much length out of it.
Uh-huh.
They're just sort of like, if it's got a, you know, if it's got a little bit of a wiggle to it, they're just kind of pulling the wiggle out because they want it as straight as possible.
Yeah. Wow.
But the service I was offering was cut to length.
Mm.
So you say, you know, you're building this laser and you want a 400 millimeter piece and two 200 millimeter pieces. I would deliver those to you. So I didn't know what size to order because people were just ordering random sizes.
Sure, sure.
So I ordered the longest piece I could handle, which was 20 feet long.
It delivered to your house 20 feet
long? Oh, I went and picked it up.
Oh my God.
In a rented Ryder van. Drove it home and loaded it into my garage, and I created a cutting operation there. Which was interesting because to get the best yield, I used some yield software, which basically takes all your orders and puts them into
An optimizer.
An optimizer, yeah. And this was like a one-dimensional optimizer. So there's 2D and probably 3D, like for packing a truck optimizers.
Sure. Well, Oshpark, when Lane was on back in the day, he always talked about building an optimizer for
It's like nesting of parts and stuff like that. And it was pretty interesting. So I had like a web store that would take the orders in. And then the more orders you process at once, the more optimization you can get.
Yeah.
So it would print these labels out in, totally automated. So it'd print these labels and in order of my cuts. And then I would cut, stick the label, and the label would have the length and who it went to. So I might need to cut 10 or 12 of these 20-foot pieces. And it's actually really easy to cut. You just use an aluminum chop saw. And then it might take 12 pieces before one order got filled. So they'd be stacking in these little stacks around the room.
Yeah.
And then it would say, you know, one of whatever. So then I would know when one order was filled, and then I would ship it off. But it was literally taking me probably about 25 to 30 hours a week on top of a of a management of engineering job.
Yeah, right.
I was eventually getting kind of burned out. I didn't know what I was going to do.
Yeah.
That's when I approached Inventables. I said, why don't you guys fulfill it for me? And Zach Kaplan, the CEO, who I'd known for a while, jumped at the opportunity and said, okay, yeah, we'll fulfill it for you. He was going to do it in a different way. He was just going to get, you know,
standard,
stock lengths.
Standard pieces, yeah.
Standard lengths, because it really is pretty easy. Yeah. It was a smart move on his part.
Mm-hmm.
Then he started paying me a royalty, which was... a real success because here it is, a fully open source product that anybody could actually use on their own. But Inventables was like, no, we're happy to pay you a royalty, you know, to help us set this up and stuff like that.
That's great.
And they still pay that royalty.
That's great. Yeah.
It's, you know, going on like 8 years now.
Yeah.
Because it's used on the X-Carve.
Okay. Right. And which it's, I'm sure we'll get to as well here. Yeah.
Yeah.
So what is Inventables for people who don't know?
Inventables is a like desktop 3D carver company. They make the Carvey and the X-Carve. They did the Shape Oko when that first came out. So that's their whole business. It's just these 3D carvers and all the materials to support that. They also have... an online CAM program called Easel, which is very popular and it's great, especially if you're just getting into
super simple, super
simple. And you know, they've got a big team that works on it, and you know, it's very quickly catching up to more higher power CAM.
No. Yeah, it's like a bottom up kind of innovation thing.
Yeah, and it's really easy. It's kind of live. You know, you drop a circle on one side and you see your piece of wood suddenly have a circle cut out of it on the other side. So it's really quick feedback like that. And it's more, the way of thinking is not like CAD, it's more like Illustrator.
Okay, yeah.
Where, you know, instead of like filleting and things like that, you could just move a circle onto a corner, you know, and subtract and stuff like that. So I think a lot of artistic people have... a shorter learning curve.
Yeah, that's good. It's interesting too, because I feel like tools like that, as they move along, that ends up impacting future CAD innovations, right? So like Autodesk in 10, 20 years, right? When people that started in elementary school potentially using Easel, right, they're going to be like, oh, well, all of our users expect this instant feedback type thing. And obviously some of them are going to learn parametric, but some of them are going to ask for these features, and it'll just eventually start to kind of impact how features are developed.
Right. And, you know, like their native import is SVG, which is like so far away from the CAD world. Like, you know.
Yes, I do know this.
Like I have, you know, I use Creo or Pro Engineer, which has exports like 80 different formats, you know, 2D and 3D, and none of them are SVG, But, you know, it was a smart move because it's really, you know. It's
the language of artists, right?
Right. They don't know what a DXF is or, you know, things like that. So, you know, that's kind of where it's focused. But the way I met Zach was originally Inventables was selling a lot of materials to laser cutter people. And they would give... like Epilogue, these kits of little samples that people could use. So he reached out to me and he says, hey, I was looking for, you know, the number one open source laser out there, and was surprised to find, you know, it's just 2-3 miles from our office.
Chicago,
yeah. And so, you know, he was like, you know, he actually gave me some of these kits and gift certificates for people to get started and things like that.
Yeah.
And so struck up a friendship with him, and... you know, one thing led to another. And the company I was working for was going through a sale to a competitor. I wasn't really that interested in moving, you know, working for this competitor. And I had this open offer from Zach. So I joined Inventables.
Nice.
And that was about 7 years ago.
Right. And it dovetailed nicely with your already interest in all the other CNCE things anyway. So
yeah. So at the same time that they took on MakerSlide, they took on the Shape Oko. Mm-hmm. Through Edward Ford, and he did the original Shape Oko, and he worked there before I did for a while. So as I was coming on, they had already got a little start, but they were looking, you know, to a little more focus. So I came on as I think my title was director of product, but I was basically the engineering director and stuff like that.
Yeah. Guy who builds things.
Guy who builds things.
Guys who tells other people how to build things too.
Yeah. And but it's a fun company to work for. Yeah. I mean, everybody there is so enthusiastic, you know, and it's not like, you know, it's taking me back to the Williams days, you know, where it's just fun, you know, interactions in the hall and everybody's excited about everything and hangs out afterwards and plays with the equipment. So that was real fun to work there.
Yeah. So what are the three? So there's the, you said the Carvey, the Shape Oko, and then the
X-Carve.
So what are the differences between them?
The Shape Oko was the very first machine made out of MakerSlide.
Okay.
and Edward Ford did a Kickstarter on it at the same time. Mm-hmm. His Kickstarter was more like, I want to make an affordable CNC machine. Give me some money and I'll figure it out.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And
real open.
Yeah. And, it resonated with a lot of people.
Yeah.
And he was funded and stuff like that. But halfway through the Kickstarter, he's like trying to figure it out, you know, mm-hmm. as the money's coming in. And I had my Kickstarter going on at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, hey, that's exactly what I need to make this thing work.
That's a good idea.
And he's like, do you mind if I take it and make a router out of it and a CNC router? And I said, no problem. So that's how the Shapeoko got started.
Mm, got it.
And then he eventually left Inventables to do a new version of the Shapeoko on his own.
Mm-hmm.
So we needed to quickly change the Shapeoko to differentiate ourselves. So we did the X-Carve.
Mm, got it.
And sort of beefed it up in a lot of areas. And we made it for sale with a configurator, so you could sort of buy it with all these different options. Mm-hmm. We vastly improved the electronics
mm-hmm.
And really beefed up the power of it
mm-hmm.
And made it look a little cleaner with the black look and stuff.
Right. And so in both cases, they're like, so it's like an H format, right? So like rails on...
Yeah.
There's like horizontal, if we're saying vertical rails, and then there's like a center, the H piece is like going across, and then the...
Yeah, we call that the gantry.
Gantry, that's the word. Thanks, Bart. You know your stuff. You should get into this.
Gantry is like supported on either end and has, a moving carriage on it. Uh-huh. And it's an easy way to get a stiff machine out of like low-cost components. Sure. A lot of 3D printers are that way.
Yeah.
And a lot of milling machines, and even the the ShopBot is that way.
Sure, yeah.
Which is ShopBot is a pro level machine.
Some people don't like the ShopBot software. I've heard so.
Yeah, but I mean, companies buy it. And
yeah, it's big too, and that's the other thing. And so the rigidity matters because you're now spinning a bit and you're pushing it through material. It's milling effectively, right? So you got that horizontal force you needed to know where it is in 3D space.
Yeah,
right?
And you don't want the machine to bend.
Mm-hmm.
Flex, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still an entry-level machine, you know. It's made for people to put together on their own and experiment with. And
mm-hmm. Cool, okay. So what are the electronics that are driving that kind of thing?
There's a software program that runs on an Arduino called Gerbil.
Mm-hmm.
Gerbil.
G-R-B-L is the acronym.
I've got on good authority that it's pronounced every one of those ways.
Oh, okay. Like Kaiken.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And I call it Gerbil.
People say Garble, really?
Garble.
Yeah. Okay.
Gerbil. Yeah. Like
seems,
I said.
Seems like that's a little more negative connotation. You know?
Yeah. Like I said, I call it Gerbil.
Yeah.
I'll probably call it three different ways throughout this talk.
Yeah.
Which was written by a guy in Europe. And he basically was trying to put a CNC controller onto the Arduino. It's kind of like uh-huh. putting a ship in a bottle. That was his analogy.
Okay.
And like, you know, you can't do this on an 8-bit 16 megahertz thing. And he did it and did a good job of it. Mm. And then it was picked up by another guy by the name of Sonny, who took it much further, put like a higher level motion planner and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And it's really high quality motion planner. Mm-hmm. on an Arduino, and just about all the RepRap, Marlin, Repetier, and stuff like that took its original motion control from Gerbil.
Oh, interesting. Okay. So these are the firmwares that are written more for 3D printers, but you're saying that like the bones of it are
the Gerbil. Bones of it that like you know, can I get from here to there uh-huh. in a clean and efficient way?
Huh. Is it written? Is it because you need to have a lot more math functions in there? Like, what is? I don't know anything about it. So, what are the hard parts about doing like a motion controller like this you're talking about?
It's a lot of math.
Mm-hmm.
But like doing a straight line from point A to point B, you have to accelerate and then go at a constant speed and then decelerate.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're doing that in three axes with three different motors,
oh.
and each motor might have different max speeds and max accelerations,
mm-hmm.
coordinating that.
Got it.
And then, so that's one thing, which really isn't that hard of a problem to solve. But if at the end of that line, you're now going to take like a 15-degree angle off of that,
okay.
you come into that corner, coming to a complete hard stop and then restarting is, you know, the basic way you would do it. But let's say you're doing a circle. Sure. Things get a lot more complicated.
Yeah, right.
And a lot of these are actually breaking it down into little line segments and doing a motion plan that allows it to not come to that complete stop. And so it's whipping around the circle. It looks like it's just cruising. And it's very accurate. I mean, it's like hundredths of a millimeter accurate that it's breaking it down into. But that's where the big math comes in.
Got it. Sines and cosines, huh?
Yeah. Well, you want to, you know, you want to avoid as much floating point math and as much canned libraries and things like that.
So it's like all lookup tables and stuff like that? Or
no, it's just avoiding a lot of that stuff.
Okay.
And you know, hard coding some stuff and a lot of register level access. You know, there's not digital write, you know, pin 11 high.
Right.
It's more, you know, poke it right here, you know, at a byte at a time so that you're doing three access writing at a time and stuff like that. So you're pushing a byte into a register that's now handling eight outputs, you know.
Oh, really?
Wow. That's how it's optimized. But they originally had to do it through, you know, compilers and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But then they cleaned it up so that it could be compiled right out of the Arduino IDE.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's pretty accessible that way.
Yeah. So why did it stay? So it sounds like it was started as like a challenge to get to the something efficient. But why did it keep doing that when there was obviously other? It was just because it was accessible to anyone because of low cost or?
Yeah. Well, so when people were starting to get away from the Mach 3 and the Linux CNC and looking for a cheap alternative, you don't want to run Linux CNC on your 3D printer.
Yeah.
And what accessible hardware is out there?
Mm-hmm.
It was the Arduinos and the Arduino Mega.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the basic Uno was what was running most 3-axis CNC and the Megas. I don't know if you've heard of like ramps controllers or stuff like that.
Yep.
You know, that's
So it's got like 1284 on it or something like that, right? The Mega is a Mega 1284. I don't know.
No, 2650.
Yeah, 2560.
Yeah, something
like that. Yeah. Okay.
The Mega.
Okay.
And that's, you know, and
okay, so it was just to make it low cost and widely
super low cost.
Accessible.
Yeah. And so that back to like what's in the X controller, which is the controller for the X carve. It's got that as the sort of the motion planner, and then it's got stepper drivers and things like that. And a lot of people use these plug-in stepper drivers that you've seen on rep wraps and things like that, which are like, you know, dual 8-pin rows, and they're available from like Polaloo in China and stuff. We use some higher power ones that could do like 4.5 amps per motor.
Mm-hmm.
And they also did some current control so that when the motor's idle, the current drops so the motors don't overheat.
That's good.
So that's basically it. I mean, we tweak Gerbil a little here and there. But, you know, that's what it is. You just beefed up Gerbil.
Okay. Yeah, that's good. That's good. Okay. And I mean, so, like, for someone that's getting started, I hear the sound of CNC in the background. So, someone is getting started into motion control. Like, is it something that they need to consider? Like, is it like, so if someone's listening right now, they're like, oh, what Bart's saying is interesting. Should they feel like they ever need to dig into Gerbil, or is it more? Are they going to be operating at a higher level at the beginning?
You can operate at a higher level, just through, you know, a sender, which is like sending the G code to Gerbil, because you know, an Uno has very limited RAM, so you're not like, you don't load your job onto the Uno. You're sending it a move at a time, and it's buffering them.
Got it.
But
and then breaking that out into the actual steps you're saying.
Yeah, so it can like load like 12 moves at a time and then smooth those moves. And as one is finishing up, it's loading a new one and replanning and things like that. But you need something to stream the code there.
Got it.
And that streamer can isolate you from what's going on in Gerbil, and then it, you know, a lot of them look a lot like Mach 3 and Linux CNC.
Sure. Okay.
So you don't need to know that, but you can also treat it just as like a general motion coprocessor. So if you're trying to do something totally different than CNC, you just want to, you know, move a pen along the wall or something like that for doing, you know, generative art or something like that. And you're like, okay, I can do all this front end stuff, but how do I get the pen to move? You can just almost treat it like a black box. And a lot of people do that.
So like, what would they then pass? Like, what's the example high level command they would pass then? Is it basically like X, Y?
Yeah. So it's called G code. And, like a typical move is like G0, which means move in rapid speeds. And then you give a point to where you want to go. So it's not from here to there. It's like you already know where you are. And so it'd be like G0, X10, Y10, which would move to those coordinates. And then the next move would be off of that. And if you want to move at a specific speed, it's like G1, same X10, Y10, and then feed 100, so it'd be 100 units per minute.
Got it.
Could be millimeters, could be inches. So that's pretty simple abstraction.
A little cryptic, but yeah.
A little cryptic, but it's pretty abstract from all this other mess going on behind the scenes of coordinating three axes and stuff like that. So, you know, you could write out by hand on a single sheet of paper all the codes you need to know.
Okay.
So it's not, you know, that cryptic.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, it's cryptic, but not that cryptic.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's it's not like a programming language or anything like that.
Right. Okay. Yeah, and I think the other thing too, it's good is to walk people like up and down the stack. That always kind of helps me at least. Is like understanding like, okay, so if I start in SketchUp or Fusion 360 or Blender or whatever, that is a 3D model that's on my screen, and then from there, that's either going to go into like a slicer or a what's a cam tool? That's CAD, and it goes into a cam tool like a slicer or a motion control type of thing. Is then that's pushing G code out, right?
Yeah,
and that would then go down to a controller. Hopefully, that it can
Executes the motion, and hopefully everything gets done.
Right. But then the G code then gets translated into basically step, step, step.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So that's the full stack, pretty much.
That's the full stack. Now, there's programs like Fusion 360, which are and Easel, which are breaking down that stack to look to less steps. You don't even see some of the transitions of going from my art to my G code. You're just going from what looks like your art straight to sending.
But so in the background, somewhere's
back in the background, all those steps are happening.
Okay. That makes sense. That makes sense. So you then have taken Gerbil and you've put it on a different processor, right?
Yes, I've done that a couple times. And the first time I did it on the PSoC 5.
Oh, okay.
And that was so easy. I think I did it in 3 days.
Wow.
And
why PSoC 5?
I love the PSoC 5. Yeah. It's I don't know if you've ever used it.
I've not. No. But I've heard you talk about it a lot, I think, and other people. It feels like people that are into it are like really into it.
It's got a great IDE where you visually map out all the peripherals, and you can sort of create peripherals on the fly and stuff like that. You know, you're sort of drawing out of a pool of resources, creating these different peripherals. So if you want an interrupt to you know, toggle a pin, you can do that in all in hardware, kind of FPGA like. But so what you're doing in Gerbil is you have these interrupts, you've got all these pins doing different things. Like when you send a pulse to a stepper motor driver, it has to be a very specific shape. It might have to have a direction first, then a short delay, then a pulse length and stuff like that. That eats up a lot of resources on things like the Arduino and stuff like that. You can just create those pulse shapes right in the so, and also you kind of like, what's the code for an interrupt? You just drag an interrupt out on the screen and say generate an API for that interrupt I've just pulled out. So it's really, really quick to get up to speed on the hardware. There's no looking up data sheets like that. And then if you are, if you do need to know,
lots of masking.
If you do need to know like some of the deeper stuff, you just kind of like right click on that thing and it brings up the data sheet.
Got it.
And there's a data sheet for each peripheral, not like this, you know, 1200 page data sheet of everything. So I've always used it for prototyping, because if you have like ADCs and DDAs and all this stuff, You know, you got this breadboard full of all these things. In this, you're breadboarding on the screen. But it's a very expensive chip. For a hobbyist, it's like $15, and it's a complicated thing. So I usually prototyped on it and then switched over to real hardware that I could afford in quantity. But I ported it to that, and it worked great. It was so easy to use and things like that.
So what about the porting process, too? Because, like what – so Gerbil's written just – regular code. You said it wasn't compiled anymore, so it was still like Arduino accessible type stuff. So like what kind of functions do you need to actually move over though? Like,
Well, it's all written in C, so you're working in C in both areas. Sure. So like the motion planner, it is almost drag and drop, you can do some optimization because you are working in 8 bits versus 32 bits on the PSoC 5 now. So like all you know. Some of the math gyrations are going through. You might be able to simplify some of that.
Yeah.
But I worked from the outside in. I needed all these peripherals, and I said, okay, I need three timers. I needed a PWM and some of these other interrupt and pulse gyrations I had to do. So I got all those, made sure those things worked, and then it was very easy to plug in the rest of Gerbil.
Okay.
So it was really really pretty easy.
That's great.
But I didn't get a lot of traction with that project. Put it on GitHub. A lot of people were interested, but without any real hardware for anyone to operate it on, it really never took off. And then when I started making these smaller devices and putting Bluetooth on them, the PSoC 5 didn't have Bluetooth. It didn't have Wi-Fi. So I'm adding more modules. It's getting more complicated. And that's about the time the ESP32 came out.
Mm-hmm.
And that seemed like the dream chip for me because it was cheap, super tiny, and had all these radios on it that I could use.
Why did you want those? Just for easy access to the thing?
Well, at this point, I'd left Inventables, retired.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't get to that earlier. But,
blah, blah, blah. Yeah. done with the
professional robots. Now I do the consulting and some sales and stuff like that. But I'm self-funded on all these little projects I want to do. And so I'm just tiny, tiny scale and, trying to bring my whole CNC machine to Hardware Happy Hour.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So that's when I wanted to go really small, and I did not want to bring a laptop that I would also have to power up and find a plug for and stuff like that.
Right.
So that if I could just run it off my phone, that would facilitate these small scale machines. What's the point of a machine that could fit in the palm of your hand if you also need a laptop to run it?
Right.
That's why I started putting Bluetooth on a lot of things. And
And you started bringing things like the little the Nickelbot and the
Nickelbot, the Polar Coaster, laser coaster cutter, things like that.
People have probably seen me posting tweets about them incredulously every time. I'm like, look at this thing that Bart brought to another meetup. Makes us all look bad, but it's also awesome. So
yeah, there was a lot of pressure. I had to come up with something every month, but that was the impetus for doing the ESP32 stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And but that's a completely different animal than anything I've ever worked on before. When I first jumped into it, the documentation wasn't great.
Mm-hmm.
They were just bringing it into the Arduino IDE.
Yep. That's right. Angus, who was doing that stuff.
And that made it attractive because I was still, wanted to overcome the problem with the PSoC, which was people were intimidated to work with it.
So to make a community around it, pretty much.
Make a community around it. So it was really important for me to use the Arduino IDE. And the documentation that was out there was really at the IDE level, as if you were, doing Arduino Blinkies and stuff like that.
Sure,
It was a lot harder for me to port it over because at this point I'm dealing with multiple cores, RTOS, and all this other stuff. Okay. So. And some of the things that aren't documented are what works in interrupts, what works in the RTOS, what doesn't. The API has, the public functions defined, but what's going on behind the scenes.
So how much did you have to use that stuff? Were you only using APIs, or did you have to dig down deeper?
So my plan was to use the primary core that the IDE uses for the Gerbil stuff. Okay. And then reserve the other core for the Wi-Fi and Bluetooth stuff.
Yeah.
Because if you're refreshing web pages from your phone and stuff like that, I did not want that to wreak havoc with the step generation.
Right, exactly. It's like halfway through a step, it's like, no, wait, hold on. Got to do a post. Got to do a get, you know.
I was actually doing that. Yeah. It was actually well-behaved and everything was coordinated, but it would like, you know, stutter and stuff
really?
Like that,
wow.
You know, when I wasn't getting it right.
High network traffic, so you could tell, real easy.
yeah. And so by using the one core and avoiding the RTOS for Gerbil, mm-hmm. I was using just a primary thread and interrupts. Mm-hmm. And but the API is very RTOS friendly.
Got it. They expect you're going to be using it.
They expect to be dealing with the problems of someone using the RTOS.
Yeah.
I hope I'm getting all this right.
No.
But so when you crack open the API and look at it, you're like, there's all these mutex or however you say it.
I say mutex, but yeah.
And
like mailboxes
like,
and all that
stuff. Yeah,
yeah. Semaphores and
everything stop, do this, everything start, and you're like, no, that's not going to work for me.
Right. You want it basically just a straight ahead microcontroller level type of thing.
No, and with not having a lot of experience with RTOSes, I'm sure I could have done a better job with the RTOS. Mm-hmm. But even though I had some help with it, it just wasn't producing what I wanted.
Yeah.
So I worked on it for about 2 months and kind of shelved it for a while. Went to a SuperCon a couple years ago, ran into all the ESP32 guys
Jeroen.
He got me excited about it again, so I gave it another shot. And
he gets everybody excited about it. Like, that guy is just—he's just an exciting person, you know. He does some crazy stuff.
Yeah, I think he's got access to a lower level documentation than I do.
Well, he walks in, he works there, so you know, he talks to the people down the office, you know.
That's when I decided to really, you know, double down on it. And then it took me about another 2 months to do it, and part-time here and there.
Yeah.
It's
interesting too, because so you're talking about this thing that's running, it's got 12, you'd throw 12 step commands, I think I'm saying that right, mm-hmm. to like an Arduino-based Mega 328 style one, or Mega even. But like, so then what was the difference in terms of productivity of like, now it's running an ESP32 on a single core. Is it like, you can do anything with it? Is it like way better, or is it just kind of the same and similar?
It's hard to quantify that, because I mean, if you add up the numbers, it seems like it would be huge.
Sure.
Like, you got 8 bits versus 32 bits.
4x.
I don't know how that math actually works, you know, I mean, especially when you're trying to do 32-bit mm-hmm. math.
Yeah.
You know, it's hugely more efficient. It's also got FPU on there.
Okay.
It has two cores, you know, and the Arduino is running at 16 megahertz. Those cores are running at 240.
Yeah.
You know, so like if you start multiplying.
Yeah, it feels like it's just some horsepower differences, right?
But yeah. It's much, much faster. And then the RAM is much, much higher.
Uh-huh.
You know, these 12 commands you can put in the planner, I don't know how many. I mean, I've ramped it up to 100, you know, and it just, at that point, it just seems kind of silly to go any further. Mm-hmm.
At a certain point, you're not even streaming anymore. You're just storing it in RAM, right?
So you're buffering up that much more, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's running. The basic step generation, an Arduino Uno or Mega is probably going to max out at about 30 kilohertz.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, your interrupt is almost going to start stepping on itself, you know, because the divisions, you know, are running out of space there.
Mm-hmm.
Now we have the I say we because a couple of people helped me out. It running at 120 kilohertz, so it's 4x faster on the step generation. And at that point, even if you're like 32x micro stepping and stuff like that, stepper motors just don't go that fast.
Sure, right. There's just physical world limitations, you're saying.
Yeah. You know, when you're running a motor that fast, the power starts dropping off on a stepper motor with high step rates. And so then it just runs out of power and just can't keep up.
Mm-hmm.
So we really haven't pushed it further than that.
Okay.
probably could.
Sure, but at this point, who cares, right? I mean, you're at the point where you want to put other functions in it, or you have this tool now that feels like you're developing with it.
Right. So that was finished in about September of 2018, mm-hmm. and so that's been very stable since then, demonstrated on a lot of machines. Started developing some controller boards that people can use it on. Mm-hmm. I sell those on Tindy. Done some OEM sales of them with people putting them in various things, and
which is crazy. I mean, like, you now have an ESP32. What, like, one of those little ESP32 breakout boards were like $6, $7. I mean,
the cheap. Amazon price is about 10.
Sure.
And the AliExpress price is as low as 4.
Right. But if you even just bought a module, you could buy a module for 3, and so you could also design it into a product if you wanted to.
Yeah. You could buy the module cheaper than that, I think.
Yeah. But the accessibility is pretty high. That's the thing I was getting at, is that, like, okay, now you can have motion control without the steppers, at least, for pretty cheap. And now you're building robots that are without the steppers themselves now, or what, like 25, 30? What are you selling on Tindy for, like, your controllers now?
About $40.
Okay. So $40, right?
Yeah.
Versus 20 years ago, what would that have been?
I don't know.
Yeah,
right. It would probably cost $150, $200 or something like that,
mm-hmm.
Or more. And they wouldn't be as sophisticated.
Right. Or accessible. Right?
Yeah. So since then, been working with some people, and we put a complete web UI onto it. So now the sender that, I was talking about, how you interface, mm-hmm. is now a web page. So you run it in your browser.
Mm-hmm.
That is served from the ESP32 itself. So it's basically just completely collapsed that whole end of the tool chain into on-chip.
So what would you put onto the web page then?
So the web page is like jogging controls, like a command terminal is on there. Mm-hmm. The whole, like, I want to change my max speed. Used to have to go to a terminal and type, $3 =
uh-huh. Right.
1,000.
Now buttons and
now it's
sliders.
Buttons with descriptions,
right.
and things like that. And it's giving you a DROs, digital readouts of your position.
Wow. Has Mach 3 come for your head yet? Or what? I mean, they're charging what, $600 for whatever that 20 or 5 year old software is.
I don't know.
But that's like what it would be replacing, kind of, right? I mean, like, Mach 3 was that software level kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's it's more replacing the senders, because Mach 3 is it's the step generation, it's all that stuff, and it's a lot deeper than that. Like, even Linux CNC is way deeper than that.
Sure,
that's
sure,
what, like,
okay.
the Tor Mach and stuff like that is running on,
mm-hmm.
Which is a commercial CNC.
I think that's what
machine.
We actually heard before was the
Tor Mach, so.
PNC 1100, yeah,
and. So, and the other thing is now there's SD card interface is kind of standard on all these cards.
Mm-hmm.
So you just, like, through your web page, you upload the code onto the micro SD, which is on the module, and then you can run it from the web page. So you basically mm-hmm. have everything right there.
Got it.
And since we have the SD card and the web UI, we're considering as a next step is to put, like, an ESL-like program
Ooh.
Right on there. So now you almost have everything. And it's going to start out simplified by using, like, an SVG to G-code generator. So you bring that in, drop it on the web page. It does a conversion for you, mostly for things like drawing machines and stuff like that, where you don't have, complex feed rates and lead-ins and stuff like that, where you're just, like, touching a pen and drawing. But you have virtually infinite capacity to serve material from an SD card through that web page.
Oh, and you're saying there's, like, enough RAM to actually run, like, a program that could do all that other stuff?
Well, it would be just served to the web page, and the processing would be done on the browser side.
Oh, interesting. Okay. So, like, it's a JavaScript-based...
Exactly. So you'd serve the JavaScript to your web page.
Interesting. Okay.
So we could do, like, G-code visualization, all that stuff.
Yeah, that's cool.
So
that's cool.
We're pretty excited about that. Most of the web work is being done by a guy named Luke he's in France. And he also is working with some other programs. So it's sort of like a universal web front end for this stuff. And he even has it for the ESP 280-266.
Uh-huh.
If you just want, like, to put it on ramps.
Okay.
You know, you just plug in the 8266 put.
Oh, and it's like a retrofit almost.
Yeah.
That's cool. That's a great idea.
Yeah. So so now when I demo a machine, I have an SD card with all of the demo code I want to run. Mm-hmm. I open up my phone, I hit go, and then I can close my phone, and the thing will run totally autonomously.
Because the file, you're saying, because the all the G-code file is on that SD card.
Yeah, which is being pulled off by the ESP32.
Okay, so if you were going to have, okay, so if you had the KiCad logo, because you've made stuff like this before, the KiCad logo is a G-code, some point has been converted to G-code. You're saying that this web front end that Luke's doing would basically allow you to then on your looking at this file now, you'd basically be able to re-render it and say, oh, that is the KiCad logo?
Exactly. Now, he hasn't done any of that yet, and sure, he might not be the one who does it because he's not he's an expert in, you know, like a web UI, but not necessarily SVGs.
Sure.
Yeah, that could be done. You could just drag and drop an image. And a lot of the stuff like Easel and all this plotter art and stuff like that, their native file is SVG.
Uh-huh.
So that if you have like this universal step where it goes to SVG, whatever to SVG to then G-code.
Right. It's like these ad hoc translation layers effectively.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you say if you create something that goes to SVG, we got the rest of the chain for you.
Nice. That's great. That's really great.
So if you can pack it onto the SD card.
Right, and then the storage capacity is another thing, is like insane, right? You can get like 128 gig for pretty cheap.
Right. So what's nice about the way it works is, you know, I'm taking this machine to an unknown location, like Hardware Happy Hour, some random bar. Mm-hmm. I have no access to their Wi-Fi, so it's going to come up into an access point mode, and then I can get on that access point with my phone.
Yep.
Then work it that way. So at that point, I don't have easy access necessarily, like especially with a phone, to the larger internet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I am trying to get as much as I can right there. Mm-hmm. You know, like if you get a logo, you might download it and then switch over to this access point. You know, but if it were in your home use, you would immediately put it on your home Wi-Fi, and it works after that.
That's great. So okay, let's talk about some of the machines you built too. So we've talked about the NickelBot. What is that?
The NickelBot is a wooden nickel engraver, laser engraver. It's about the size of a brick.
Oh,
a little bit bigger.
Taller, right?
It's half a loaf of bread.
Half a loaf of bread. That's good. Yeah.
Half a loaf of bread.
Yeah.
And it's got a hopper. You load the hopper vertically with wooden nickels, and then a little bed moves under, picks up a nickel, clamps it, and then moves it under a laser. And then it laser etches it.
Of course, yeah.
And then when it's done, it ejects it out the front.
That's right.
So that was a fun one. And it seems like I'm demoing a lot of these things, you know, at events and bars and things like that. So it's always nice to have a worthless tchotchke to take away. Mm-hmm. And these nickels cost, you know, 4 or 5 cents from Amazon if you buy a big bag of them. And they're pretty uniform size. And that's just a good way of demonstrating it. And I always like to bring something that's kind of a conversation starter. Mm-hmm. You know, they see the laser blinking in there. And
sometimes you see the laser when someone's opening up the thing to do some maintenance during the bar times. And I look straight at it. I'm like, oh, my God, I'm going blind. And then you tell me that that's actually not how it works. But
that's not how it's going to work. Yeah, but, it's definitely I avoid that. All my laser boards have now, like, interlocks on them and stuff like that. So if you open up a door, it's going to shut it off. But, of course, everybody's, like, trying to peek through the cracks and see it and stuff like that.
Yeah, you want to see a laser if it's there, right?
Which is it's reasonably safe, you know. It's not going to hurt anyone because the laser diffuses so fast. It's actually defocusing really, really quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. But I usually put a window on which has a filter for the laser so that, you know, the laser doesn't come out, especially these visible lasers. Mm-hmm. Like an IR laser is not going to go through glass, but the blue lasers will, so you have a filter. And then they're looking through the window, and they see it kind of like getting brighter and dimmer and brighter and dimmer, but they can't see the laser.
Mm, yeah.
So they're always kind of trying to sneak away in.
Yeah, right. And then you did the same thing. That was the coaster you did as well, so there was another.
Yeah, so another one I did was the cut square coasters. And to make it as small as possible, it was a traction feed. So the width of the machine was actually smaller than the size of the coaster. Mm-hmm. And it would, you know, poke in and out through the front and the back. And it would cut shapes out of a drink coaster. Mm-hmm. And then it would pop it out the front and you'd poke out the shapes because they were kind of loosely fit in there. And that was another good demonstration.
Yeah, yeah, that was interesting too, because I had never really thought about a robot having the extra, I guess the Y direction in that case was just a roller, and then the X was the actual gantry going back and forth.
Yeah,
and that's the only two motions that it needed.
A lot of like vinyl cutters and things like that work that way.
Okay.
Or old school like HP pen plotters, where they would just move the paper back and forth.
Yeah.
And then they could use roll paper. They could use anything like that. So yeah. I took that idea. And the coaster, again, is a very well-controlled size. Mm-hmm. So I could make it just for that. And that you had to feed it in. But it was kind of cool because it would kind of grab it out of your hand, mm-hmm. do this little etching, and then spit it out the front.
Yep.
So that was kind of a crowd pleaser.
Right. Well, it's amazing, too, when you think about it. Like so many CNC machines, I think this is like what Nadia worked on a lot too, is that like so many CNC machines, it's like linear motion, rotational motion. Those are the two things. And it's like you could have some other more unique, not unique, but like exotic type motions, but most of the time you don't need them, right? It's just you know, putting these things together. So then you took the more rotational and you did another coaster bot, so.
Yeah, well that's sort of like what really interests me is exotic kinematics. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of my machines incorporate some weird kinematics, and that was where the Polar Coaster came in. That was using round coasters, drink coasters. Mm-hmm. And
we should probably not go to bars as much anymore for these events. Huh? You just make all these coaster things.
I enjoy it.
They do have beer.
And so when I thought of the round coaster, I thought, well, how can I exploit the round shape? Mm-hmm. And that was by making a polar-based machine. Mm-hmm. So it's basically spinning the coaster and just moving the pen, and it only has to move from edge to center because it can get anywhere by rotating the coaster to get there.
Yeah, right. So it's just about breaking up the line segments so that they kind of match that new paradigm, right?
Yeah. There's a lot of crazy kinematics that are involved, and mm-hmm. Gerbil doesn't natively handle kinematics. Mm-hmm. So initially I would make polar post processor, so it would break a line mm-hmm. into little segments and then do that. And I don't know if I could do a good job of describing the problem, but if you were to draw a square centered on a coaster, you're basically dealing with four points, all equal radii from the center mm-hmm. when you're drawing this.
Yeah.
So if you told a polar machine to draw that, or a non-polar machine, it would leave the pen down between those points.
Sure. Yep.
There is no change in radius. The polar machine would basically draw a circle with those four points exactly
right.
in the same spot.
Right.
So I hope I did a good job of explaining the problem. So if you broke that line into uh-huh. two pieces, now you would get a point in between those two points on that square, but it would make a hump between doing the same problem.
Okay.
So you keep breaking it down until the hump is basically below your threshold of, like, I would say, like, a quarter millimeter. Mm-hmm. So it might be 100 lines. But Gerbil loves little lines. It just slams through them and like they're not even there.
Right. As long as they're sequential too, it'll actually look
as long as they're
smooth.
Sequential and there's not a strong angle between them.
Okay.
So like if you did a really acute angle, Gerbil will come to a complete stop because it can't effectively round that.
Uh-huh.
But like a square, it actually does a little bit of rounding that you can't see, which cuts down on some of the stop and acceleration.
Interesting. And so that's just what that's actually a good tie back to the software too, because that's what it's actually doing.
Yes, that's the secret sauce of a motion planner is how it enters and exits corners.
Hmm. Okay, interesting. All right, so what about some other tool? So then let's see. So you did some other drawing tools as well. You did the draw badge. Was that next or was that?
Yeah, I did the draw bot badge. That was back when badges took over for fidget spinners.
Uh-huh.
I had to get into the badge life realm, and I made a drawing badge, which used hobby servos.
Mm.
And I'd done a couple other hobby servo projects, so I was familiar with that. But that was some crazy kinematics going on there as
What about that?
There's like two... You'll have to like post a link so anyone can see.
Tons of links, yeah, in the show notes. So.
Two servos are adjacent to each other, which moves some arms. So it's like a four-bar linkage.
Because of the shape of the arm, you're saying?
Because of the position of that I had to put these hobby servos in. Uh-huh. And they were cheap hobby servos. They were like $1.10 each from China. So they weren't real accurate. And so it was kind of, I called it adorably wiggly lines that it would make. That was a fun project. I think I did a workshop at SuperCon with that. I think I took on a little too much ambition on that project, tried to make it a full-fledged CNC controller that could do anything when really it just needed to be a badge. So it was kind of badge life hell for about a month and a half.
People doing too much for badge life. Who would have thought?
But it was a fun project.
Yeah. So before you go on with this stuff, so you mentioned like the breaking it down into lines and like having to do this math, the polar to Cartesian, right?
Yeah.
What are you doing that with? Is that all like Python, or what are you doing that processing with?
So I generally do it in Python, and it's like a script. But now that it's on the ESP32, I can actually do that in real time.
Okay.
So when it sees a line, it'll actually break it down in real time before Gerbil actually needs it. It'll break it down into the thing. So there's like built-in, I call it like a basic kinematics. Mm-hmm. It's not like true kinematics where there's inverse, forward kinematics, stuff like that. It's just basically pre-processing it before it gets there.
Okay, so let's go back. So you're saying when it's a line, it would be that same G0, X10, Y10, right? That's the thing saying go 10 units right and 10 units up or whatever it is. That's the line you're talking about?
Yeah, so if it were like, it would break that down to the point where it's not visible anymore. So I would like add in it's going to deviate from the perfect path. Mm-hmm. And in the kinematics pre-processing, it says don't deviate more than a quarter of a millimeter. It's whatever you want.
Sure.
You know, it gets more and more lines the deeper you go. Mm-hmm. But if you've got a pen that's twice that diameter that's doing the drawing, why not use that number?
Okay.
So that was done in a Python script. It would just take the G code in one end and spit it out the other end. Just same kind of
G code in, but G code out.
G code in, G code out.
Got it. Okay.
But, you know, 400 lines in, 6,000 out.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Yeah. just cause it says this doesn't look like it's going to be possible. Yeah,
exactly.
Do these other sub moves.
Right. But when you're drawing the KiCad logo, it's already 400 lines, you know, because there's so much detail there. So it might only add four or five extra ones for, you know, the asterisk somewhere, so it doesn't necessarily explode it too high. But ESP32 will just do it on the fly. And I've done that as a demonstration project on, I can't remember what, which one I did that on. I think it's the string machine.
Okay.
So I have a proof of concept that it works in this sort of pre-processing route. What I'd like to do is a more pure kinematics where it's sort of inverse forward kinematics. I'm probably not going to do a good job of describing this.
I'm pretty out of my element right now. So.
But so when you're kind of throwing away a lot of what the machine is capable of when you're doing this pre-processing, because you have these like accelerations, maximum acceleration in any axis, max speeds and things like that. And that's kind of lost in this when you get to exotic kinematics. Gerbil still thinks it's working in Cartesian space. So,
Is it because like if you had a line that was then broken to three segments, right? You would normally, if it was able to do the whole line, it would accelerate at the beginning, accelerate at the end. But now you're cutting into three, so now you accelerate and decelerate three times.
So, like if you have a exotic robot arm with six axes, you know, what you really want to deal with is the acceleration and stuff of not only the tip. Mm-hmm. But each joint has its limitations. Mm-hmm. So, it's non-linear. So as this pen might be moving or whatever your end effector is on the robot, the joints might have to work at the same speed of that end effector. The joint might have to move at different speeds along the way. It definitely will have to.
Oh, got it, got it.
And so you have to, a true kinematic will also take into account those joints.
Got it.
So you're no longer talking about axes, you're talking about joints, you know, and so you say, move this tip at this speed. Okay, I'll do that, but I'm also gonna deal with all these other joints as well.
And so then it's optimizing for, you basically bound the problem for a particular joint, you're saying. You can go this fast, you can't accelerate this fast.
Yeah,
and then that has to play back into the model, you're saying. And then,
yeah, yeah. Now things like Linux CNC do that natively.
Got it.
And so that is the true way to do it, where you just have two equations, a forward equation and a backward equation. You know, there might be not equation, like more like
matrix
methods,
box.
giant long methods. But there, some of them are pretty trivial.
Yeah.
But then you can like abstract it from the machine a little better.
Okay. And that's what I was gonna ask, because it seems like
you could do a wall plotter, you could do a string machine, you could do a robot arm, you know, and then everything else stays the same.
Right, because it seems like the a Boston Dynamics has got really, really optimized joints and everything that's on there, right? All their kinematic models are figured out, but they know that machine. And it's like, you're talking about prototyping new machines. You prototype every month or two, you've got a new thing. So is that what you're saying, is being able to abstract it so that your next prototype also takes advantage?
Yeah, that it's more of a universal solution,
okay,
where it's easy. And then there's like a trivial kinematics for Cartesian. It's like X equals X, Y equals Y, Z equals Z, move on.
Yeah.
And then like for a core XY machine, which is like... like an Ultimaker machine, or the MPC&C
Well,
that's not Core XY, but
it's where the actuators in the middle.
And it's like a T-bot.
Yeah,
I probably got a couple of those wrong, but you know,
but there's like these styles of machines.
Yeah,
you're saying.
Then you have a set of formulas for that. And, you know, it's much much more universal solution.
So you don't have to rewrite a new translator until you make up a new weird way of doing things, right?
Yeah. And it's also, you know, it's not so bodged into the code like it is now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you mentioned the StringBot. What's that one?
The StringBot was my most recent machine, and that's a string art. And I did a great video on it, which explains it entirely. But basically, and I won't do justice to the video or how I explained it, but basically you're making art with string. And I saw it on Hackaday a couple of times, and I saw a circular one where it's nails around the perimeter of a disc, and you run the string from nail to nail. And I've always been interested in string art, and I said, I got to make one of those. And this was an interesting like design process I went through. I was like swamped with other projects, so I had this like in the back of my brain, and I think I almost...
You talked about this at like three different lunches.
I keep talking about it, but basically it never was my fingers on a keyboard or pencil to paper, like just months of just running it around my brain. And it was kind of an interesting way, because I like had the machine like completely designed and just never any time to actually make it. And then finally I got a time to do it. And so basically I based it on my Polar machine, because why not spin the bed, make this tiny little mechanism that only has to move in and out of the nails. So you got one accurate axis, which is the spinning of the table. It has to be accurate enough that you get your to thread in between the nails. And then all other axes are just dumb. They're just either in or out. So it was very, very simple machine. There's like a drilling rig that drills for the nails. There's a needle that runs it in and out, and that's about as good a job as I'm going to be able to do it describing it.
Yeah, the video made it was good for that.
Yeah, and so it was just a lot of fun to make. Everything went well, and you know, it looks great, and it was a fun project.
The software seemed like it was the tripping point, though.
The software, there's a lot of people that had done the software for like the string paths and stuff like that. So all I had to do was modify it for my machine, you know, just the basic for the G code that comes out of my machine. The software's crazy. It takes, you know, 6 hours to generate the to generate it. And that's right. I had to make it get down to 6 hours. I had to take my machine up to 32 gigabytes
of RAM.
of RAM,
yeah,
and a state-of-the-art, you know, plug-in SSD, because there's still a lot of disk swapping going on.
Right. That's crazy.
Yeah.
It's a lot of math. Yep.
Yeah. But once you cross that threshold of like there's enough RAM, then the time just drops.
Yep.
You know, by a tenth.
That's good. Yeah, it's weird too. I mean, it's weird to me to think that like after all that, so you have these images, right? And now that you've got you said in that video, you use MATLAB for generating this thing. But then at the end of the day, it's still G code that then goes down to motion steps, and like it's that same kind of path each time. And,
right.
Like, do you ever see that changing? Like, is there a reason to? I guess I don't know if that's a stupid question or not, but like.
Yeah, there's probably a lot of opportunity for changes. There's like, these are all stepper motors, which are all open loop. But mm-hmm. once you start getting into closed loop, things like that, you know, you still run the same process. But maybe instead of, getting the needle to run through the nails, you know, in such tight coupling, you just have a camera that watches it, and it's like, oh, it's sure. a little close. Let's move this thing yeah. this way and stuff like that. Right, you could close the loop in different ways. Not everything has to be super accurate.
Mm-hmm.
You're trying to get from here to there, like especially with robots.
Yeah.
Like if you're trying to get a robot to tie a shoe, you really can't program that. It needs to see the lace and how it's laying and things like that.
Right.
So, in those type of things, yeah, I see a lot of areas for that to go, and then maybe you can make it back into CNC, you know?
Yeah, right. Well, that's what I mean though. Like, so say you have a vision system today, right? And your thing knows that it's a shoelace and it says, okay, now flip the shoelace over here, and even calculates the path, you know, okay, the little arm has to go from X1 to X2 or whatever, right?
Yeah.
It's still it's still like, there's still some G-code-esque command there. And maybe it's just because that's, I don't know. Like Gerbers are never going away. Probably not going away. You know, G code doesn't seem like it's going away anytime soon.
Yeah. Well, it's like one of the things I think about is like jogging a machine.
Mm-hmm.
If anybody's used a CNC machine, you know, you hold the key down and it slides left, mm-hmm. and then the page up and it slides in the Y.
Mm-hmm.
But like actually like getting it to target like right over where you want to be is annoying as hell.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of want to just like,
you know, the pick and place that's out here is not too bad on that. It has like a picture of the bed. You click on the bed.
Exactly.
And it goes there, right?
Right. Well, there are some centers that do that.
Sure.
But, you know, more like if you had a joystick, where you're just kind of swinging the joystick around saying, I kind of want to go this way a little here. That you're swinging the direction around, but you're swinging the target around. And I think that's maybe what the Neodent does, where you're like, this is the place I want
to
go.
Right, and then it's back calculated from there.
Yeah. Now, definitely they're using stepper motors. Sure. They're using probably some G-code behind there.
Cheap. That thing is cheap. The Neodent 4 is not expensive. So.
You know, so that, and there's senders that do that, where you can like click on your thing and it'll go there.
Mm-hmm.
But getting away from so much hard, you know, exact go this way, go that way. I think there's a lot of opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I kind of like this compartmentalized
mm-hmm.
idea of the motion planner, because then I can like abstract that away.
Sure. You're like, I figure this out once, I'm done with it, right?
Yeah. And like that it is now my, motion control little worker that all I have to do is say in this high level language, do this, do that.
Right. I actually would be very surprised if I walked up to the bench and I saw you working with something that was not an ESP32 in the near future, because it's like, why would you redo that? Unless there's some real reason to do that, you know?
Yeah.
Because it's done, right?
Right.
It's, you know,
unless there's a better one, I guess.
Well, yeah, of course. But I'm saying is that like you're saying with the compartmentalized, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. But I don't really see the need to get away from the Gerbil-based stuff, because it's plenty powerful for what I need to do.
Yeah.
It's just the peripherals around it that I might change. Like right now, ESP32 doesn't have a native USB.
Mm, yeah.
So like you said, you can get it for $2 and plop it down, but you need the support structure around it and stuff like that. It'd be nice if it had native USB.
I've heard rumor that I heard rumor at SuperCon that Nespressif might have one. So
I heard a lot of rumors too. Yeah, I didn't, they kind of nod,
Yeah, right.
But this chip 7 or whatever they call it had no evidence of that.
Mm-hmm.
Plan
when we get there, right? Yeah.
Yeah. But the nice thing, if it had native USB, is not only right now it's it's USB to serial, mm-hmm. you could then have, you know, it would mount and look like a flash drive or things like Got that, it. Drag yep. and drop, mm-hmm. and, you know, everything that USB can do
yep.
Would come into play.
Yeah, that's real nice. Yeah, I do like that on the SAMD chips.
Yeah.
That's real nice.
You know, once it's native, then the USB is free to do what right. USB does best.
Right, and dropping stuff on boards, too. It's just you drop it down, hook
dropping
up D+.
Dropping firmware.
Yeah, yeah right, exactly. Yeah, that's great. That's
yeah. Killer.
So that helps a lot.
Yeah.
Well, what else should we know about you, Bart? I mean, we've been going here for 90 minutes pretty strong, so...
That's about it. You know, yeah. I kind of dwelled on that I'm, like, semi-retired. Yeah, like, I left Inventables, yeah. you know, to, you know, just kind of pursue things that I want to do on my own.
Yeah.
So a lot of this stuff is kind of fanciful and, you know, not
too... For funsies.
Funsies, yeah. yeah. And but I have been, like, trying to get this going... Mm. Yeah, you know, if you're interested, check out the GitHub mm-hmm. For
we
that.
We didn't even bring up Twang. I didn't even think of
that. Ah, Twang.
Oh, come on. It's another project.
It's an LED project.
Yeah.
But
back to your gaming roots, though, too.
Yeah, but, you know, and like to move the project along, I am selling some of the controllers on Tindy
yeah.
and, you know, looking for any opportunity to move it forward.
Mm, yeah, yeah. Interesting manufacturing stuff coming up, I think, too, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Hopefully I'll do some more OEM stuff.
Yeah, that's good. Well, cool. I'm excited. I mean, I'm always excited when you come to meetups and stuff and bring more robots, so it's good to have that. I think that this is, you know, like given your background too and your, you know, you're a software, electronics and mechanical. It's all together. It's like a really good, you know, meeting point of all those things. I like that as an example of like No. This is like you need all these disciplines, but it's also now it's accessible. It's open source. It's great. I mean, it's really great to see more people doing it.
Right, and it's a lot of it's self-taught.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I had some formal training in mechanical engineering, but firmware and electronics and things like that. And there's a lot of things I've done where I was just like intimidated as hell. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you just push through it. I think, like, on the Carvey machine, we needed a new bootloader. We were trying to find someone to write a bootloader, and that sounded like the most scary thing in the world.
Right, right.
And finally, it was, like, over a weekend, I said, well, how hard can it be, you
know? Yeah.
It's, you know, and I did it, you know? And
that's great.
And
it is that. I mean, sometimes it's like saying, like, someone's done it, so I could probably do it, right? And it's, like, but it's time and then resources and, you know, everything else, and then... chunking at it, you know, like
right really yeah like you know everybody's got those like I sure would love to know how to use FPGAs, you
yeah,
know
yeah. Spend some time and
dive maybe, in
right and ask for you know ask for some help online or whatever right that kind of thing
make a promise you can't keep
yeah right start selling a product why not right well Bart thanks a lot for joining me here
okay well, it was a great pleasure
all right thanks man.